From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Ed Ryder served 20 years in prison for a murder he says he didn't commit. His life sentence was just commuted by the acting governor of Pennsylvania. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Ryder and James McCluskey, the minister who believed in Ryder's innocence and worked for his release. Also, we meet Barbara Cook. Stephen Sondheim once described her as one of the two or three finest singers of song. She originated roles in The Music Man and Leonard Bernstein's Candide. Now she's one of Cabaret's greatest singers. And Stephen Schiff reviews the new film The Piano, starring Holly Hunter and Harvey Keitel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The UN Security Council voted unanimously today to extend the mandate for the mission in Somalia. The mandate was extended for 6 months until May 31st. It was purposely extended beyond the end of March, when American troops are scheduled to leave. Diplomats said the resolution is designed to signal to Somalis that the United Nations will not abandon the country. The resolution included an instruction to UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali to present a detailed report on the mission's future as soon as possible. Buoyed by his victory on NAFTA, President Clinton has arrived in Seattle for trade talks with Asia-Pacific leaders. They're attending the Forum on Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation. APEC already represents 50% of the world's wealth, and it just got bigger. NPR's Ted Clark reports from Seattle.
APEC was formed 4 years ago by 15 Pacific Rim economies, including the U.S., Japan, and China. It was announced today that Mexico and Papua New Guinea have also been admitted to the organization, expanding its reach farther down both sides of the Pacific. Chile is expected to join next year. Now that Mexico belongs, all three partners in the NAFTA trade agreement are also members of APEC. The long-range goal of APEC is to lower trade barriers throughout the Pacific, much as NAFTA would lower them in North America. This would stimulate economic growth on the Pacific Rim, where growth is already the fastest in the world. This is Ted Clark in Seattle.
In Mexico, yesterday's approval in Washington of the North American Free Trade Agreement is being presented as a turning point in U.S.-Mexican relations. NPR's David Wellner reports from Mexico City.
There were complaints in today's newspapers about how many times Mexico was insulted during yesterday's NAFTA debate on Capitol Hill, but there was also praise for the show of good faith in approving the trade pact. A leading congressman from the ruling PRI party called yesterday's vote a triumph, which has knocked down a 150-year-old wall and will allow Mexico to trade with the U.S. and become more competitive. Another member of the ruling party said a failure of NAFTA would have forced Mexico to tighten trade controls and increase protectionism. Cuauhtemoc Cardenas, who's the leading opposition candidate for next year's presidential race, said there should be a reevaluation of the NAFTA treaty since he claimed Mexico had made some bad deals. But Commerce Secretary Jaime Pucheserra denied Mexico had renegotiated any of the trade pact with the U.S. in order to assure yesterday's victory. I'm David Wellner in Mexico City.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 19 points to close at 3,685. Declines led advances by a margin of nearly 2-1 in heavy trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 311 million shares. This is NPR News. The Senate is trying to complete action on a $22 billion anti-crime bill, but it's being delayed by a dispute over the Brady handgun control bill. Yesterday, senators agreed to ban the manufacture and sale of 19 kinds of semi-automatic assault weapons, but they haven't been able to reach agreement on the handgun measure. The Brady bill would impose a 5-day waiting period on handgun sales so that police can conduct background checks of potential buyers. 24 conservative senators have introduced their plan to reform the nation's health care system. As NPR's Patricia Naymond reports, it's the second Republican Senate challenge to President Clinton's plan.
This bill, sponsored by Oklahoma Senator Don Nichols, promises consumers a greater choice of health plans than President Clinton's proposal. But unlike the president's plan, it wouldn't require employers to provide benefits. Instead, it would require individuals to purchase health insurance and provide tax credits to help them do so. The Nichols bill would reform the insurance industry, prohibiting it from denying coverage to anyone who is older or sick. It would pay for reform much the same way President Clinton would, through large cuts in the federal Medicare and Medicaid programs. But it would do little to control costs compared to the Clinton plan, which would set a yearly budget and limit how much insurance policies could increase each year. Two more Republican bills are expected to be introduced in the next few days. I'm Patricia Naimond reporting.
Ukraine's parliament voted overwhelmingly today to ratify the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. Of the former Soviet republics that have nuclear weapons, Ukraine was the last to ratify the treaty, but it did so with a list of conditions that could take years to implement. Ukraine wants the right to eliminate the nuclear weapons on its territory in stages. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Ed Ryder, served 20 years in prison for a murder he says he didn't commit. In September, his life sentence was commuted by Pennsylvania Acting Governor Mark Singel. Ryder, who is now 42, has been released from prison but will remain on lifetime parole. He learned to play trumpet at Graterford Prison, and tonight in Philadelphia, he will play at a benefit jazz concert in his honor. Also with us is the minister who led the drive for Ryder's release. Reverend James McCluskey is the founder of Centurion Ministries. His mission is to work on behalf of prisoners he believes are innocent. He spent 2.5 years investigating Ryder's case and discovered old inconsistencies and new information that convinced him of Ryder's innocence. In 1973, Ryder was in a Philadelphia city jail serving time for petty theft, when a fellow inmate named Samuel Moulton was murdered. 4 men, including Ryder, were convicted of first-degree murder. They each had a separate trial. McCluskey read all 4 court transcripts.
Reading the transcripts, one is struck immediately at face value that this was a bad case because it primarily consisted of two jailhouse career criminals, violent career criminals who were in deep trouble with the district attorney's office here in Philadelphia. They came in and offered conflicting testimony that incriminated Ed. They offered 2 different stories in terms of who they saw, what they saw, when they saw it, who they were with when they saw it, and how many people participated in this crime and who did the crime. It was just impossible to reconcile these 2 accounts. Something was wrong.
You actually tracked down a witness to the murder, and I believe it took you 10 months to find him. What did he tell you once you found him, and how did you find him?
Well, first of all, his name is Keith Webb, and both jailhouse witnesses against Eddie Ryder, who offered conflicting testimony about what they saw and when they saw it, both said, however, that they were standing with Keith Webb when they saw what they saw. Nobody ever asked Keith Webb, what did you see?
No one in the trial.
Nobody at the trial. Keith Webb's name was mentioned as by both of these jailhouse witnesses, but Keith Webb was never brought in. The obvious question is, well, let's go talk to Keith Webb and see what he has to say. Well, by the time I started doing the street investigation, 17 years have gone by, but I was able to find him. I found him in a Pennsylvania town, and I presented myself to him. Initially, he thought I was a police officer, so he's a little bit worried and scared. But nevertheless, after he settled down and I introduced the whole subject matter to him and I assured him that I was not a police officer, he quieted down and calmed down, and we talked about this situation for 1 hour. He said, look, I'll never forget that day. You don't forget when somebody is murdered and you see that murder begin to take place, especially when you're in prison. It was vividly etched in his mind. And he said there were 5 men who did it. The leader of the 5 came up to me because I was standing nearby the victim's cell and told me to get lost. Something was about to jump off. So I left immediately and went down towards my cell, which was in the front of the cell block. and as I passed the victim's cell, I looked in, saw him sleeping, saw five men, two standing outside as guards, and the other three get ready to go in to do the deed. And I showed him a photo array of seven or eight different men, and he identified the five killers. Ed Ryder's photo was in that array, and he said this man, pointing to Ed Ryder's photo, definitely was not there. I don't ever remember seeing him before. And then he came forward and gave us a statement as to who he identified and what he saw, and it exonerated Ed Ryder, and also, I might add, demonstrated that the two jailhouse witnesses were lying.
My guest, Jim McCluskey, is the founder of Centurion Ministries, and this is a group that he founded with the mission of working on behalf of innocent people in prison. With us now is Ed Ryder, and he's the person that we've been talking about who was recently freed after the acting governor of Pennsylvania commuted his sentence. Ed, how does it feel to be out? You've been out just a few weeks now.
Yeah. Feels good. I mean, I feel good. I'm glad I'm out. I guess my happiness is sort of tempered with the reality that I wasn't supposed to be there from the beginning, you know, but overall I feel good.
Has the world changed a lot since you were outside? Are there a lot of things that are unfamiliar and things that you don't know how to use?
A lot of things I don't know how to use.
I'm even thinking of something like money machines that didn't...
Yeah,
I don't know if
I never even been to a Mac machine. I don't even know how to use it. How would I don't even know where to begin, you know, but I don't know. A lot of things has changed. I think people's changed a lot, you know, especially in... I went through my old neighborhood a couple of days ago with Howard Goodman. We were just riding around.
Howard Goodman is a reporter from the Philadelphia Inquirer who's been writing about your case for several years.
Yeah, he's my buddy, you know. I mean, we just rode around and we looked at different things, you know, and there's so much blight. You know, all you see is a bunch of empty buildings, torn down houses. And
in your old neighborhood.
Yeah, and the people, you know, you can almost see hopelessness and despair in their eyes, you know. People that I knew years ago, I mean, they just look worn out, you know. And it's surprising, you know, they'll come to me and tell me, oh, you look so good, you look just the same. And I'm saying, well, because I'm thinking, well, I'm the one who's been through 20 years of complete hell. So I should be the one who's really wore out and ground down. But I think the world's done a lot to...
Take us back 20 years ago. You were in prison for a small crime, for stealing money from someone who was drunk. It was like less than $100.
$50.
How long would you have stayed in prison if it was just on that charge?
Well, I wouldn't have stayed because that charge was thrown out. The guy never even came back to court because he got the $50 back. He never even came to court, so that was thrown out. But I was already, you know, set up for this thing.
How did you find out that you were being accused of murder?
Well, at first, I didn't know what was happening because I didn't even know the guy had been killed. I remember the whistle being blown. We was getting ready to go to trial. And I went to my cell, and I'm laying there. And I don't think nobody knew at the time what exactly had happened. Well, I knew I was in jail, so I figured maybe somebody got stabbed or somebody got hurt or whatever. And then two or three guards came down my cell, and I thought this was just like routine, you know. And he come down to the cell, and he calls me out, strips me down, searches me and stuff, you know. And he tells me to come out and go with him. And at the time, I still didn't know what I was, you know, what it was taking me or what was happening. Like I said, I thought it was just routine. I thought everybody was going to go through this, whatever. But, they kept me there for like two or three days with no sleep. You know, wouldn't let me sleep. And they were questioning me, do you know Moulton? And at the time, I didn't know who
Moulton
was.
This is the victim.
Yeah, I didn't know who he was. And I'm just like saying, no, I don't know Moulton. So, you know, what is it with Moulton? You keep telling me this, you know. I just went on for two or three days. And finally, one officer came in. He had some pictures. He said, well, this is Moulton. Do you know this guy? I said, no, I don't really know him. You know what I mean? But what's it got to do with me anyway? And then he told me, well, this guy was killed, stabbed to death, and you know, somebody did it. So I guess I was elected.
When you said that you were innocent, did you feel that anybody believed you?
It's hard to say. I do know. I know guys that were in the prison knew I didn't do it. You know, because when I went to Greater Fort, there were guys there when I got there that I didn't even know and told me, hey, man, we know you didn't do that. You know?
A couple people who did come to believe that he was innocent, I think, are noteworthy. One is the current sheriff of Philadelphia County, is John Green. He's been a strong advocate for Ed over the last 10 or 15 years. He interviewed Ed at two different prisons over those years at length and believes he's innocent, and also wrote a letter to the district attorney asking, this is a couple years ago, asking the DA to reopen the case. And Mayor Frank Rizzo, Mr. Law and Order, he came after, he investigated the case, and after learning about the facts of the case, he came to believe that Ed Ryder is innocent and wrote a letter to the district attorney's office stating that.
Yes.
I believe that your lawyer, who had a problem with alcohol and was apparently not a very good lawyer, he was even reprimanded by the judge a couple of times.
A number of times. Throughout the whole proceeding, the questions that he asked were irrelevant. He couldn't hear well. You got to remember, he was very old. And he would always, he would holler, what did you say? What did he say? I mean, it got to the point where the judge was, every 5 minutes he was correcting this guy. Now, look, you're making a circus out of this thing. Now, stop. And the jury was actually laughing. I mean, the DA would do something, and he would get up and do something real crazy, and the jury would laugh at me.
Well, what went through your mind? Your life is on the line here, right? Your freedom is on the line.
I tried to fire
him. How do you, when you're a prisoner, how do you deal with
it? I asked the judge, can I get another lawyer? I want to relieve this guy. He told me this is who's been assigned to you. And he wouldn't let me get no other lawyer. I didn't have no money, so I couldn't hire a lawyer. So I was stuck with the fact of taking this court-appointed attorney or nothing at all.
My guests are Ed Ryder, who was recently released from prison after his life sentence was commuted, and Reverend James McCleskey, who believed in Ryder's innocence and worked for his release. Ryder served 20 years for a murder he says he didn't commit. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with Ed Ryder and Reverend James McCleskey. Outside, before you got into prison, you had been a singer.
Yes.
And I believe you sang with a group that years later became the Tramps, that had the hit Disco Inferno.
Yeah, Disco Inferno, yeah.
So did you sing once you got into prison?
Yeah, I sang. In fact, that's how I started playing. I started playing the trumpet from that. What happened initially is that I say in 1978, somewhere, 77 or 78, I just started singing. It relieved the frustration and the tension and anxiety, and I used to just sing. So there was a guy there named James Bennett Bump. He played trumpet, you know, and he had this band called Pure Gold.
Inside?
Yeah. Well, anyway, I started singing, you know, with them, and I guess that's the reason why I started playing, because, you know, while I was singing, they was always talking over my head, you know. The keyboard player, a guy named Sonny Brown, who's working pretty regularly at the clubs now, he would always say, no, that's in D minor, you know, I want to put that in D minor, and change that D minor, substitute the B flat 9 for that. And to me, I didn't like the idea of people talking over my head, like, you know, they'd ask me what key I'm in. I'd say, well, I'm here, to get that key, and he had to find it, instead of me saying, well, I'm in the key E minor, you know, so I say, well, I'm going to stop that.
So how'd you get a trumpet?
Well, you know, it's funny. Really, I didn't want to play a trumpet. I wanted to play a bass.
Oh.
And I couldn't it wasn't a bass there. I mean, I'm at Greater Fort, you know, there's, you know, they only have so much anything, you know. So I went to the guy who was working there at the time. In fact, Charlie Chisholm, a well-known musician today.
Well-known Philadelphia musician.
Yes, he was working there at the time. He was working there as a music teacher, mm-hmm. him and Joseph Agnello. And Joe Agnello is one of the most beautiful human beings I've ever met. I'm telling you, he's a sweet guy. Well, anyway, I told Joe one day, I said, Joe, I want to play something, you know. I'm tired of these guys talking all over my head with this D9 and augmented sixes and flat nines, and we're going to come back into the chain. He said, I know. He said, well, what you want? And I tried to get a bass. He didn't have that. I said, well, how about a tenor saxophone? So he said, well, come on upstairs. We'll look up in the shed up there that they had. And we looked around. There wasn't none there. But over in the corner was this old raggedy, dirty, beat-up trumpet. And Joe said, Eddie, now you got a choice. You can keep on singing and not knowing what they're talking about, or you can take that old dirty, beat-up trumpet there, clean it up, and try to work with it. So I looked at it, and I said, well, there's nothing else. I'll just take that then.
So do you still have that beat-up old trumpet?
No, I left that thing years ago.
You got a better one?
I got two beat-up old trumpets now. And a cornet that was given to me by a gentleman named Alan Wolf, who has classic autos on Erie Avenue. He gave me a very beautiful cornet.
I'm thinking about something that you said before, Ed, that, you know, when you went back to your old neighborhood, that you saw people who you remembered from 20 years ago, and they looked terrible. And the neighborhood had become really bombed out and everything. What do you think would have become of you if you hadn't been in prison for the 20 years? What do you think about that a lot, about what kind of life you would have led? Because I think at the time when you were arrested on the robbery charges, that you also had a drug habit then. So do you think of what would have happened to you if you were out?
I think, you know, I thought I might have, you know, probably, I might have wound up just as bad or either dead. You know, I thought about that a lot on the one hand. But on the other hand, I've always been the type of person that when I found myself getting too far on the edge, I always had an uncanny ability to be able to pull myself back. You know, even while I was at Greater Fort, and it's been times when I've actually thought about suicide right at Greater Fort. I mean, I've sat there and thought about it for 2 and 3 days, and I had sharp razor blades, and I was going to sit there and cut my wrist and just bleed to death, and I was going to do it at night after they took count, so none of the guards would see me and I can die in peace. But, you know, something inside of me would always grab me back, you know, and tell me, no, you got more to live for. You know, I've always felt, I don't know, I could be wrong, but I always felt that God had something for me to do. I don't know what it is. I could never pinpoint it, but I always felt that God had a mission for me, something to do for me in life. And my mother used to always tell me that. She used to say, you're special, and you know, you're not like your brothers and them. And she would tell me that even when I was a kid. You know, she said, something about you, boy. And she would hold me and sing little songs to me and stuff. And she said, I want you to, you remember what I said now. You're special.
Speaking with Ed Ryder, and his life sentence was recently commuted by the parole board and the acting governor of Pennsylvania, Mark Single. And he maintains his innocence throughout his stay in prison. And also with me is Reverend Jim McCleskey, who is the man probably most responsible for bringing this case back to the attention of the public and the parole board. And McCleskey is a reverend whose group, Centurion Ministries, has taken on the mission of working on behalf of innocent people in prison. Jim, I want to bring you back into the conversation. You have had several people who you really believed in their innocence. You did a lot of detective work over a series of years, tracked down sources, reopened cases and so on, and got them out. And you've watched people before in the position that Ed is in now, the position of having just gotten out, and you don't know what life holds ahead for you. And it strikes me as a very vulnerable position to be in, because you don't know your way around the world. The world has changed. You don't have, you know, you're not trained in a kind of job necessarily, you know, that's going to pay you a really good living, at least right away. So is this a very vulnerable position or vulnerable period?
Without a doubt, we've been able over the last 10 years to free and vindicate 13 people who were innocent and wrongly convicted and given life or death sentences. And, of course, the longer you go out, the longer they've been in prison, the more difficult it is for them to pick up their lives and make the emotional, the psychological, and the physical readjustments. And I would say half of those people who we have freed have had such a difficult time that they've resorted to alcohol, drugs. Their anger has come out in distorted, twisted ways because they refuse to deal with their anger. When we would suggest that they go to get psychologists and counseling, their culture says that that means they're insane, so they fight that and they don't do it. So their anger comes out in ways which that ends up in assault and batteries, and they're back in the local jail again. Now, that's happened with half of the people we freed. The other half have been able to fight the demons off and pick up their lives.
Is this the kind of thing you talk with Ed about the problems of this transitional period?
Most definitely. Ed and I have spent hours and hours talking about this. And Ed is very cognizant. Intellectually, he's very cognizant. And I think probably even more so than the other people I've worked for, even though he's been in prison for 20 years, I'm really very confident that Ed will be able to make these readjustments and maybe in a shorter period of time than others, just because of his own special nature. He's a gregarious people. He loves human beings, and people love him. And he's got this music skills, and he's got a tremendous support system here in the city of Philadelphia. So I think Ed's going to make it just because of who he is. But those of us who love him and care for him must continually be with him and give him the support that he needs throughout the years.
Is it frustrating for you when you help get somebody out of prison and then they have a lot of trouble and then back in, as has happened with half of the people who you got out?
Yes, I have to admit it's very frustrating. And sometimes there was one of the people we freed became very, very mean-spirited, and he and I had a vicious encounter. I haven't even quite gotten over that. I feel a sense of betrayal, but as the district attorney in Los Angeles who freed him told me, "Jim, you didn't do the time. He did." And he was down for 17 and a half years in Los Angeles. But it can be emotionally you're diminished emotionally by these kinds of experiences. But yet, on the other hand, everything's a mixed bag. Then you have a person like Ed Ryder and a number of the other people we freed, and you see them really pick up their lives, and there's a redeemed life, there's a resurrected life, and there's no greater joy than to see that really take root over the years after they get freed.
Ed, is it overwhelming to have choice now? When you're in prison, a lot is taken away from you, and one of the things taken away from you is the ability to make decisions.
I love it. Today, as you well know, the L broke down. I mean, I had to be back here at 11. I mean, it's frustrating, but it's a good frustration because for so long I was without these things. I mean, the things that people look at as being, oh, I just can't. I mean, I welcome these things now. I get my clothes out the cleaners. I love having to go pay this lady to get my clothes out. I mean, it sounds crazy, but I do. I mean, when you've been deprived of these things for so long, you know, there's an old saying, you never miss your water till your well runs dry. The things that most people take for granted now, they're precious little things to me.
I wish you a lot of luck.
I won't need it.
Ed Ryder's life sentence was recently commuted by the acting governor of Pennsylvania. James McCluskey is the founder of Centurion Ministries in Princeton, New Jersey, which works on behalf of innocent people in prison. Tonight, Ryder performs at a benefit concert in his honor at Zanzibar Blue in Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. ¶¶
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Barbara Cook used to be known as one of Broadway's ingenues. She was the Music Man's original Marion the Librarian. And she originated a role in She Loves Me, which is back on Broadway. Now in her 60s, Cook has been called the High Priestess of Cabaret. Coming up, we'll meet her and hear music from her new CD featuring songs by Dorothy Fields. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Piano, starring Harvey Keitel and Holly Hunter, directed by Jane Campion. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Washington, supporters of the North American Free Trade Agreement have praised President Clinton's legislative abilities in getting the agreement approved in the House last night. However, opponents of the agreement renewed their threats to withhold support for Democrats who backed the treaty. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
House Democratic leaders who were split over NAFTA are now speaking of the need to put their differences behind them, according to House Speaker Thomas Foley. Most Democrats opposed the agreement, but 102 voted for the pact. They are the ones most likely to feel the heat from organized labor come next November's elections. AFL-CIO President Lane Kirkland says that rank-and-file union members have strong feelings against the treaty.
Those feelings are deep-seated, they will linger, and they should not be minimized.
Labor's deep pockets have provided campaign funds for most Democrats now in Congress. Kirkland says he was not threatening Democrats who backed the accord, but other union leaders were more blunt, said one were going to get even at the polls. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
President Clinton is now in Seattle for a meeting with Asian leaders that he says is an effort to drive down trade barriers. On his arrival there this afternoon, Mr. Clinton promised to put together a long-term partnership for growth and opportunity. The president will also push for Asian support in getting Europe to reach agreement on a global trade treaty by December 15th. However, Asian leaders are expected to resist some U.S. plans because of concern that Washington will try to use the meeting to dominate their nations through trade. Reaction across Europe to last night's NAFTA vote has, for the most part, been positive. NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports from London.
European community leaders watched the NAFTA story unfold with interest and frustration. There was concern that if the House of Representatives failed to endorse the agreement, then attempts to reach a global trade agreement under the GATT would also fail. They were also aware that GATT negotiations were on the back burner while the administration was busy trying to persuade representatives to vote for NAFTA. Now, they feel they can finish the Uruguay round of GATT trade talks. Sir Leon Britton, the EC's trade chief, said the commitment to open markets demonstrated by yesterday's vote will greatly assist the successful conclusion of the Uruguay round by December 15th, the deadline for completing the talks. GATT Director General Peter Sutherland said the NAFTA vote represented half a victory for free trade. The other half will come when GATT agreement is reached. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
The government says the number of people filing new claims for jobless benefits fell in the latest reporting period. The Labor Department says new claims for benefits dropped 20,000. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 19 points to close at 3,685. This is NPR News. Flight attendants at American Airlines are on strike after contract talks failed to reach agreement on work rules and health benefits. The airline says it will replace all strikers. Their picket lines up in 40 cities, and flight attendants say that they will stay there during the heavy travel Thanksgiving holiday period. The union said the walkout will be within the time allowed by law, under which the flight attendants cannot be permanently replaced. Pilots will vote tomorrow whether to stage a sympathy walkout. UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali has called for a new international resolve for dealing with ethnic conflicts. During a speech at West Point, he also indirectly criticized a U.S. decision to pull out of Somalia. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
It was the third major speech by Boutros Ghali as he tries to rally U.S. public opinion to support U.N. peacekeeping and not to ignore ethnic conflicts. He warned that in cases where governments face disaster or simply disappear, as in Somalia, the international community must respond, that it cannot resign itself and pretend solutions are not possible. Inaction, he warned, will only mean the spread of anarchy. Quoting Julius Caesar, he said that civilization is fragile. But at the same time, in what appeared to be a reference to the U.S., he said advanced societies tend to hesitate. They want to avoid hardship. Boutros Ghali added that in order to preserve civilization, nations must act in the early stage of a crisis. To delay will only mean greater difficulties later on. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
The House has joined the Senate in moving against violence at abortion clinics by a vote of 246 to 182. The House voted for stiff fines and prison terms for those who attack patients at abortion clinics. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Barbara Cook has been called the High Priestess of Cabaret and one of Broadway's most beloved lyric sopranos. On Broadway, she originated the role of Marion the Librarian in The Music Man and co-starred in the original production of She Loves Me, which is now back on Broadway in a popular revival. She also starred in Leonard Bernstein's Candide. Her concert career has taken her around the world. Now she has a new CD called Close as Pages in a Book, featuring the lyrics of Dorothy Fields.
We'll be close as pages in a book, my love and I, so close we can share a single look, share every sigh, so close that before I hear your laugh, my laugh
I asked Barbara Cook about her early Broadway career. She had sung before, but the first time she acted was in her first Broadway musical, Flahoolie.
When I first started doing them, I had never acted. And when I got Flahoolie, I was just floored because, you know, I really hadn't been here long trying to do this. And I got a leading role, Jerome Cortland. And I played the, the juvenile and ingenue roles is what you would say now. And the thing is, though, we didn't have secondary roles. They were the primary roles, so that the storyline hung on our storyline. So we had a lot of responsibility as far as the show goes, and I was very nervous about it. I was convinced all the time that I was going to be replaced by somebody in the chorus any minute. You know, so I was quite nervous. I'm a nervous person. Listen, I'm just finally beginning to settle down a little bit in my old age.
How has nervousness affected you over the years?
I don't know. I guess I just went ahead and did it anyway. I'm surprised sometimes when I think about it how I was surely one of the most nerve-wracked people you've ever known.
Well, what were the symptoms?
Oh, well, my hands would perspire so much that, perspiration would just drip off the palms of my hands. Honest to God, I'm amazed. And I was just always so nervous about how people going to like this or think about that. And it took me a long time to settle that. I don't know. And yet, at the same time, I always had a lot of confidence in my singing. So there's that dichotomy there that I don't completely understand. For instance, in Flahoolie, as I say, I was sure I was going to be replaced any minute, and I developed all kinds of nervous ailments that I'd never had before. And I remember we were in Philadelphia trying out the show, and I remember coming in one evening saying to myself, if this is what it's like to do musical comedy, I've got to try to find something else to do. I can't stand this. I can't take this. And at the same time, I remember hearing an orchestration for the first time for one of my songs. And I wasn't able to phrase a particular line in the same way that I had in rehearsal, in the way that I wanted to do it. And so the conductor, Maurice Levine, said, "Barbara, you know you're going to have to do this a little differently." And I said, "But Maurice, you know, that doesn't work that way. Change the orchestration." And he said, "Barbara, we can't change the orchestration. It's expensive and blah, blah, blah." And I said, "Well, Maurice, you know, they hired me to do what I do. And I can't do what I do with this orchestration like this. So they changed it." But when I think back, that doesn't sound like somebody who's very scared, does it?
No, it sounds like someone who has chutzpah.
Yeah, doesn't it? So I don't know, those two things existed side by side.
So you had confidence in your singing, but maybe not so much confidence in either you as a human being or something.
You got it. Right there, you said it.
In your early days on Broadway, you had the image of the ingenue. Now, what exactly does that mean?
Well, I don't know. A lot of the roles I played were not really ingenue roles. I just think I looked so much like an ingenue that people thought of me as the quintessential ingenue for years. Certainly, for instance, when I did Oklahoma, I didn't play Laurie, which is, well, even Laurie's not really so much of an ingenue. She's a very spunky lady. But I played Ada Wannie. I played the comedy role. And the first time I did Carousel, I played Carrie. I didn't play Julie. It was only later on that I played Julie, who's really like a leading lady. So then when I did Candide, Cunegonde is like a cartoon of ingenues. She's a cartoon. And she finally, at the end of the show, she's a very old lady with a hump on her back. And, you know, it's yet I've been tagged with this ingenue thing. Isn't that funny?
So did that affect the image that you thought you were supposed to have?
I think maybe it did. I guess it did. I don't know how. I didn't think about that so much until you just said it.
One change that I know happened in your life, and this was a physical change, is that there was a period, I'm not sure how old you were, when you ended up putting on a lot of weight. And I imagine that changed the kind of roles you could get even.
Well, yeah, sure, absolutely. For a while I thought that my memory of that time was that I wasn't being sent things to do, you know, sent scripts, I mean. But that's not true. I was being sent scripts. I just didn't want to work, I think. I think it was that period when I was sort of shifting over from playing all these kind of youthful roles, and I didn't know quite where to aim myself. Do you know? It was an awkward time. I think I would have felt guilty if I just said to myself, "Well, I'm just going to take a few years off here." And so I think that's maybe one reason why I started gaining weight. I don't know. It sort of gave me an excuse to not work. I have no idea. Listen, if I knew, I'd tell you.
Right.
Boy, I don't have a clue.
Right. So what effect did it have on your work as an actress and as a singer?
Well, it kept me from working, I think, for a while there. And then what happened is in, 1973, I did a long tour all through the summer and into the fall. It was a concert of all Gershwin material. It was the 75th anniversary of Gershwin's birth. And it was sort of a big year celebrating Gershwin that year. And that was the first time in a long time that I had sung as myself, if you will, rather than singing as a character. And I loved doing it. And I remember saying to one of the agents involved, "Gosh, I really would like to do some cabaret." And he said, "But Barbara, there's no place to play." And within a year, cabaret had a kind of renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time 74 rolled around, Wally Harper and I decided to get together and see what we could come up with. And then in the middle of 74, we went into a little place called Brothers and Sisters. And we had been asked to come in for a couple of weeks, and then we stayed the whole summer. So we were there for about 7 weeks. And then believe it or not, the next stop was Carnegie Hall. Carnegie Hall with a live album being done. Because what had happened was when we were at Brothers and Sisters, Herbert Breslin, who is the manager for Pavarotti, had heard us and had decided to do this concert.
My guest, the singer Barbara Cook, she has a new album called Closest Pages in a Book. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with singer Barbara Cook. I know you've said that two of your great influences musically were Judy Garland and Mabel Mercer. And what interested me about that is that they're really opposites as performers. You know, Judy Garland was very emotional. There was always this tragic aura about her on stage. Whereas Mabel Mercer was very regal. She sang everything as an art song and sang with a certain amount of emotional distance in a way. You never felt she was necessarily singing about herself.
That's interesting.
And she was just so regal on stage. And I'm wondering what in terms of stage presence, if you felt you took things from each of them.
Well, when Judy was here at the Palace, there's a little after-hours club. It used to be called the Little Club. It was no, that's wrong. It was called the Gold Key Club. And it was a private club. You had to have this little gold key if you were a member to get in. And I knew the man who played piano there. Very often she would come over after her performance and sing some more for herself and for her friends. And so when she was going to be there, he would call me and I would come in so I could hear her do this stuff just for herself. And having a chance to observe her so close, I really learned a lot I never had any coaching per se. My voice teacher mainly was interested in technique, but I haven't had a lot of help with how do you sell a song or put it over, if you know what I mean. What I think I learned from Garland during those months was to think about shaping a song so that it had a beginning, a middle, and an end, and so that it had a kind of emotional line, do you know? Not necessarily the musical line, because I think I learned that working on Candide more, but that it had an emotional line. And that was something that hadn't occurred to me before. And with Mabel, she had this very idiosyncratic way of using words that could be so effective. That and also her take on a lyric was so personal. I'd never heard anybody have that kind of personal take on a lyric. Do you know what I mean by that? Her sense of irony was so strong, and I think actually her sense of humor in a song was greater than anybody I've ever heard. She broke so many rules. She sang consonants, you know, and you're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to sing vowels and get off the consonants.
Now, explain what you mean by that.
Well, for instance, a word like wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we would be told to hold that to hold that, because that's how you get the sound out, and to get off that next N and D as fast as you can. Wonderful. But, or to sing wonderful, do you see?
Mm-hmm.
But she would do things like wonderful.
Yes.
And it's more wonderful. So I learned that kind of thing from her.
Gee, you know, you're absolutely right. I never
and
noticed that.
A song like Remind Me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you were just going to sing that straight, you might sing, Remind me not to find you so attractive. Remind me that the world is full of men. But she would sing, Remind me not to find you so attractive. Remind me. Do you see what I mean?
Absolutely.
So it, you know, You got to be judicious with that stuff, but boy, she sure as hell knew how to do it, I'm telling you.
Well, that probably gave you permission to do things, too,
yeah.
that you discovered on your own.
Sure. I think so.
Do you think your voice has gone through different periods as you've gotten older?
Well, most voices do change timbre. They mm-hmm. get darker.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly I don't have those light, high notes like I did during the Candide days. But, you know, I have other stuff. I have a much greater ability to put emotion into a song,
mm-hmm.
much greater ability than I had in those years. It's amazing. When I used to do those cast albums,
mm-hmm.
the albums were done the second Sunday after we opened, or the third Sunday, soon after we opened. And I found that as I played the show, I found more and more things, and I liked the performances better, say, after 3-4 months, you know. What used to happen is in the show albums, I was feeling so much, and I was getting maybe 1/8 of that into the voice, you know?
Yeah, now how do you find a way to get that in?
Well, I guess it's just confidence in doing it.
It must be really good to like how your voice is changing and feel, you know, more expression going into it. And...
Well, yeah, I do. Of course, I'd like to be able to do everything. You know, I want to still be able to sing Q over X up there, but I can't do that anymore. But it's okay, because I got other stuff that I really like better if I had to choose.
Well, I love the way you sound on the new album.
Oh, I'm so glad. Thanks.
And, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, I'm just so pleased about this new album. People seem to be liking it, you know, and selling well. So it's great. I'm happy.
Barbara Cook's new album, Close as Pages in a Book, is on DRG Records.
Don't want my mammy. I don't need a friend. My heart is broken. It won't ever mend. I ain't much caring. Where I will end, I must have that man.
This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, is this the last day you'll have to cover NAFTA? And then can you put the story behind you?
I don't think so. But we will hear some reaction today to the vote in the House last night from Ron Carey, president of the Teamsters, and also from Lloyd Benson, the Treasury Secretary. Also, we'll be hearing today about the strike against American Airlines, revisions in the free speech code at the University of Pennsylvania, and we'll be hearing about the APEC summit. It's the Asian-Pacific summit that President Clinton flew out to today, where the U.S. is meeting with its Asian trading partners.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Even before its American opening, The Piano by the New Zealand filmmaker Jane Campion had acquired a considerable buzz. Campion's first feature, Sweetie, had been booed at Cannes in 1989, and her second one, An Angel at My Table, hadn't attracted much notice at all there. But The Piano won the festival's grand prize this year and went on to become the closing night selection at the New York Film Festival. Film critic Stephen Schiff went to see what the fuss was about.
If you want to get rich in the movie business just now, here's the formula. Make a film about a strong, smart, willful woman. Give her a man who's also strong but limited, whom she can't really love. And then bring in another man, a mysterious outsider, a man of action who knows his way around in the world. Now let him fall hard for her, so hard he would protect her and give up anything for her, even maybe his life. What have you got? The perfect post-feminist romance. That formula has made hits in the last year or so of movies as various as Last of the Mohicans, The Bodyguard, Indecent Proposal, Summersby, and even, I would argue, Dracula. And now it's about to make a smaller-scale hit of a movie that's 100 times better than any of those. The Piano takes place in the 1850s, Ada, a Scotswoman played by Holly Hunter, has been mute since the age of 6. Now her father has arranged for her to marry Stuart, played by Sam Neill. He's a landowner in the heart of the New Zealand rainforest. Ada makes the voyage to New Zealand with her 9-year-old daughter, who interprets her sign language for her, along with a few simple furnishings and her beloved piano. But Stuart doesn't care about the piano. He leaves it on the New Zealand beach where Ada has landed and then sells it to his neighbor, Baines, an illiterate Englishman who's gone native. Baines has even tattooed his face like a Maori. Baines says he wants piano lessons from Ada, but actually he has other ideas. He's smitten with her. Here he is, played by Harvey Keitel, at his first piano lesson. He's just kissed Ada on the neck, and now he makes her an offer she won't, in the end, refuse.
There's a way you can have your piano back. Do you want it back? You want it back? You see, I'd like us to make a deal. There's things I'd like to do while you play. If you let me, you can earn it back. What do you think? One visit for every key.
So far, the movie has been beautiful and surreal. From here on out, it's beautiful, surreal, and powerfully erotic. And in the end, shockingly violent as well. The piano hits so hard, in fact, that it's difficult to know just what it is that's hitting you. Holly Hunter's completely wordless performance is startling and persuasive, but it certainly never clarifies who Ada is. She seems to be a kind of symbol at times, pure will personified. Harvey Keitel is enormously moving and seductive, in spite of his wobbly accent. Sam Neill simmers eloquently, and young Anna Paquin makes Ada's daughter a wonderfully spooky little imp. But the movie's real star is Jane Campion. Nearly every shot she directs is a knockout, and not in the conventional picture postcard way. Using lurid reds and dank blue grays, she turns the New Zealand bush into a sensual dreamscape, with curling vines that somehow match the stays in Ada's hoop skirt, and trees and skies and mud that seem like participants in the human drama around them. She makes mistakes, too. I don't know, for instance, why a woman would write a love note to a man who's already told her he can't read. But the piano isn't built on logic. It's built on a kind of visionary intuition. Jane Campion hasn't made a perfect movie, but she's made something genuinely compelling, genuinely rich and strange.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Jim Gallopo tells us about trying to keep gang members away from trouble in L.A., where he's a probation officer. And Richard Price tells us about hanging out with crack dealers and cops while researching his novel Clockers, which has just come out in paperback. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next archive edition of Fresh Air.